I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, my name's Johnny.
Name's Chris.
Two totally average bass players, and we're here to talk all about that bass. As well as answering your questions at home, each week we take a look at the latest news, maybe break down some tones, all to give you the lowdown on the low end. This week, we are incredibly excited to be joined by the incredibly cool, calm, collected, king of good times and infectious vibes, bass educator and content creator, it's Philip Conrad.
I think we lost Philip.
Oh, no, no. He's here. Philip, how are you, good sir?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Doing really good, thanks. We had a quick catch-up before pressing record. It is mega hot where we are now. So Chris and I are slowly over this episode with all these lights around going to descend into like a sloppy mess of sweat over this. So if I'm like constantly like this and you can hear like wet noises, then that's just us, baby.
I'm already
apart from that. That's every episode. Just super, super wet. doing great, thanks. Chris, how are you? Good, sir.
I'm slowly melting. I am not even remotely built to handle this weather at all. My Viking heritage is very upset right now. But I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Can't complain. Philip, thanks for coming on. Always nice to have a guest.
It's nice to be here. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Have you had many like bass-filled things that you've been doing this week?
Actually, yes. I have a gig this Saturday with an artist I've never played with before. So I've been learning a lot of new music and rehearsing with a band that I hadn't played with before, which is always, I'm sure you guys can relate, where it's like you're learning all the music and getting the vibe for the first time with an artist. And it's been going really well. So that was most of my weekend, and working on some videos too and doing all kinds of bass things over here.
Amazing. Yeah, like straight out the gate, like we're gonna get all like the ass kissing out the way now, because I huge fan of your channel, man. Like, it is so, I can always rely on it for just like a good time, you know, and just great vibes. The whole aesthetic of it and the editing, and you know, it can see you on camera now looking so wonderfully well lit and perfect. I think it's amazing, and yeah, just so fast growing for all the right reasons, because you're think you're doing a bang-up job, sir.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. I really care about the videos I'm making, and you don't really know who's watching. And it's cool to get to talk with you guys and be like, we're connecting. Like, I really appreciate you supporting the channel. That's really cool of you.
Yeah, like, amongst all of, like, the hate and the comments and all the stuff that comes in, you know, you are doing an amazing thing, and we sometimes forget that there's people out there that we can talk to and connect with through all these things we do. So it's awesome, and we're so happy to have you on.
Likewise, I'm really happy to be here, and I really admire what you guys are doing as well. A lot of respect for this podcast and also both of you as individuals, so it's cool to be here. Thank you for having me.
No, Chris, I don't think he's ever watched an episode. He wouldn't say that if he's ever watched an episode.
Absolutely not. He's just saying that. 100%.
Begin? This isn't on mute.
I do feel like now we've gone to video, the podcast has gone even messier than it used to be, because I used to edit the audio. So all of this trash would be edited out into a nice, smooth broadcasting experience. Whereas now, because we haven't worked out how to edit it, I just don't think we're going to.
I mean, there is a solution, Chris. It's just called being more professional and being better. No. That's not how we do things here.
Don't tell me what to do, Mom.
No. Every time we have a guest, we like to start things off, get people to know our guests with three quick fire questions. And number one being, Philip, this is a hard question. What would you say is your number one base?
Okay, it's easy for me. I have like four or five bases and a synth bass. I love all of them deeply. They do different things. But if the house was on fire and my family and my animals were all safe and I could run in and get good one save. Thing, easy answer, it's this P bass. Actually, I have it right. This is my old 66 P bass. And it's got the old neck and... this bass has a story, and maybe I'll spare you the details, but it has a lot of sentimental value for me, and it's kind of the bass I had to start my professional music career, and it's my number one bass, and I think it's a bass that if I can help it, I'm never going to let go of.
It is absolutely stunning, man. So cool.
Thanks, man. The bummer is it's not the original pickups, so like in the 80s.
Throw it away.
Throw it away. Somebody put active pickups in the 80s or the 90s. So when I bought it, I put Fralin's in, Lindy Fralin, like old school, traditional passive nice. Pickups in. So it's not all original. But actually, that's part of why I was able to afford it, because when you get into 60s instruments that are all original, they're so collectible. And I'm not a collector. I'm a musician, right? So like, I want something that feels great to play and sounds great. So... I was really happy with switching those pickups out, and it's been a great bass for me. So,
it looks great. It looks absolutely fantastic. And I
thanks,
agree
man.
About the. I have a bass that had passive pickups in it, and mm-hmm. I've put active pickups in it, and now I'm just counting down the minutes until I can get some passive pickups back in it. Because like I really like active basses. Don't get me mm-hmm. wrong. I own several active basses, but. For that bass, it's just a Squire jazz bass, but it's what I do most of like the paid work with, and I just mm-hmm. really want it to be passive again. Like I don't want an active sound, and I'm like, oh, just give me some vintage, please. I can't take this anymore.
Yeah, I have a theory that every bass like wants to be something. Like it's a combination of the pickups and the strings and the action and. Everything together, all of those things are all affecting each other, and there's this perfect combination. If you can find it, I think most basses can just be slamming, but you have to find them somewhat what another bass doesn't.
That is such a good point. I couldn't agree more. And I'm just looking to my left at some of my basses all live in this little corner just onto my left, and I'm like, yeah, I can see that. It's like I've got a Music Man, which just is amazing with old rounds. Like it just sounds so good, and then a couple of other things. But you're absolutely right. I think some basses, they it's like they have a little mm-hmm. destiny in them, and you have to sort of use them and play them, and you'll play them, and you'll try different gigs and go, oh, you know what, mm-hmm. that's not for you. Like I did a relatively like rocky corporate gig a couple of weeks ago with my Godan bass, which is basically a PJ with flats. And I thought, that'll sound good, you know, it's gonna have a bit of punch. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't work. And then the same bass mm-hmm. the day after at a wedding, but it was a bit more like a little bit more Motown-y, a little bit more disco-y. And it was like I'd bought a different bass for the day. It just came to life, and you can tell, all right, you belong mm-hmm. in this corner of like my musical toolbox, actually. Whereas something else, like I really want to play my Dingwall at a wedding, like just for a laugh. But every time I pick it up and try and play like a Michael Jackson song or Prince or a typical wedding tune, I'm mm-hmm. like, I hate mm-hmm. this so much.
It just turns into ones and zeros. And you're like, I'm sorry, I can't help it.
Just can't stop playing That's like gent riffs over Kiss by Prince.
Yeah, I totally mm-hmm. agree as well. Like a P bass, the reason a big neck feels good on a P bass, and it kind of limits your playing in a way. And I think that's
yeah.
what really brings it character sometimes, and can really bring out nuance in your playing when you're limited at times. I've had it as well on the opposite end of that spectrum, where a bass doesn't know what it's trying to be. Like it was a Sandberg mm-hmm. Electra bass, and it was a, like a P bass, but a slimmer neck, and it had the like the bigger magnet pole pieces in a P bass pickup. And it and it was active and passive, and it just had no character. It had no soul, almost. Like, it played fantastically, but it just kind of gave you a sound. It didn't really give you like
the... trying to be so many things that it ended up just being a bit bad at everything.
Exactly,
like jack of all trades, master of none.
Yes, precise. That might have been the title of the video. I can't remember. But yeah, it was very much that kind of thing. Well, that was a long, quick-fire question, wasn't it, gents?
Yeah, it really was,
actually. Shall we go on to the next one?
Probably.
And we've given you plenty of time to think about this now, Philip. So, describe your playing in just three words.
That's one. That's two.
Just...
That's free.
Just
I guess I'm done. That's a really hard question, man. It's hard to talk about your own plays. It's hard to talk about your own playing. What I'd like to be true of myself, I'm not saying it's true, but what I would like to be true of myself is, I would say maybe supportive, creative, and reliable. That's what I would want to be true about myself. But I'm not saying that is true about myself. That's the goal.
I'd say that's modest, honest, and yeah, I think that's what we should strive for. Or most bass players should aim for all of those three. You know, we say it multiple times on this podcast. We are the best supporting actor. We are the supportive role within the role in the band, you know, and gel it all together. So all of those can help while sprinkling some spice in there every now and then, you know, and that's where the creativity would come in as well. So I think those are very admirable words to use, for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm not always successful with that goal, but that's the quest, I guess.
And that's okay. You know, sometimes we did have a question about... overplaying, and when you can kind of notice when you're overplaying and things like that, and it's that can come into it sometimes with creative. You can think like, well, I need to do a bit more. I want to do a bit more. I want to tickle that itch, you know, or scratch to tickle that itch. Is that what people do to itches? No, they scratch them. You want to scratch that itch for creativity and flair, and sometimes that can go pear-shaped and go the wrong way, and you lose what the other two words are, you know, which are being that supportive role. So yeah, makes total sense. Nice one. Last then, but not least, tell us, how did you get started with playing bass in general?
I think I was 15, and I remember noticing a bass for the first time, seeing someone playing what I recognized as a guitar-shaped instrument, but hearing lower frequencies and being fascinated by that, and seeing like the person just being cool and making everyone dance and being like, I want to do that. And I had friends that played guitar and drums and sang, but I didn't really know any close friends that played bass. And I was like, man, that sounds like a really cool thing to learn how to do. So that's where it's. And then once I started doing it, I just loved it and I kept doing it. So.
Absolutely. I mean, that is such an important thing that people always forget, is that like, oh, what are you dancing to? They're like, the guitar. And you're like, no,
it's no, the you bass, aren't.
You know,
nope.
Yeah, and then there's us singing.
I didn't
along
understand what it was. Yeah, exactly. Well, I didn't understand what it was. You know, I was just like, "There's something cool about that. I want to try that."
Yeah,
and I was right. Bass is cool.
Who'd have thought it, huh? We've been trying to tell people this for so long. Okay, guys, bass is cool.
I know.
Bass, honestly, it is. No, don't turn off. It is cool.
Please.
But yeah, I think that's great. I mean, because in your full-time work, you're a boom mic operator, aren't you?
Well, yeah. Right now, no. If you've been following the news over here, the strike is going on. So
badly
there's
timed
no
question there,
film work right now.
Yeah, sorry.
it's okay. I mean, I'm choosing to see it as an opportunity to do more of YouTube and to do more creative musical things. I used to play bass full-time. I played full-time for like maybe 7 or 8 years, and then I had a hand injury. And then when I had that injury, I had to pull back from playing a little bit, but I had a recording experience from music work. And I live in Atlanta, where it's a huge film industry city. So I was like, how can I take what I know how to do and reapply it, and pivot and take the skill sets I have and try and do something else? And that's how I started to work in the film industry. So I'm a boom operator. I work on set, capturing the dialogue of the actors. And then in between movies or television bands, and now I'm a little more selective. I used to do every gig, every music gig I could get. And now I'm more selective, and I do the ones that I want to do. And I go back and forth between film and music, and I'm thankful to have that opportunity. Actually, one of my guys were on film set. He used to come for Zac Brown. So he was a touring, big-time drummer. So he gets it, and he loves music, and he's been really awesome and supportive of me continuing to do music and making it possible for me to pursue musical opportunities, but then also doing the location sound work. So I genuinely like doing both.
That's amazing. I mean, some people can't even find one thing that they enjoy doing to do for their, you know, their line of work. So for you to have both, you know, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool.
Really, yeah, cool. Man. It's cool. It's fun.
And yeah, I hope all is good with you at the moment, with work kind of shutting down in one area, but like you said, perhaps opportunities opening up in another. So it's really cool to have that as well. Of course, the YouTube channel doing its thing as well, mm-hmm. doing really, really well. I think you definitely touched on a load of things in there that we'll dive into later on with some of the questions that people have submitted. If you want to ask a question on this podcast, you definitely need to go over and follow us on our brand new Instagram page at In The Pocket Pod. That is where we will now be taking all of your questions. Okay, so definitely go and follow us on there. Make sure you look out for the post, and you're going to comment on there now. Previously, we did it through our individual stories. Now it's all in one place, baby. So go and check it out.
Johnny, I genuinely thought you were going to end that with, that is where we're taking the questions. Stop bothering me. That's because, and also, we did also have a problem where people would submit questions to me, and then I'd have, like, the day from hell for, like, 12 hours or so, and then come back and go, oh, the story's deleted. I missed every question. So if I never got back to you on a previous episode, don't take it seriously. I hate my phone.
Whoopsie, sorry. Yeah, it's all in one place. We will see it, and we do save up your questions. All right. So if there's some that we might not have answered, they're a bit more generic, and you know, and we save them up for episodes down the line. So if we don't answer them, don't worry. We might get around to them in the future. Chris, do you want to kick us off with question one?
Yes, I do, but I've just remembered. This is our 50th episode.
Ah, congratulations, gents.
Yay!
Thanks very 50th much. Episode. What a better way to celebrate.
Absolutely. 50th episode, and I think it's the 26th that we've co-hosted it, which is pretty good. So Johnny did a whole 25 all on his own and then made the terrible mistake of asking me to come on and join it. So happy 50th
some
birthday
say,
to us.
Yeah, some say that's where it all went wrong.
And they would be right.
That's no small accomplishment, guys. Nicely done. It's hard to be consistent with a creative endeavor like that, so I applaud you.
Oh, well, thank you. I did read somewhere that it was something like, I'll get the percentage wrong now, it was something like 90-something podcasts never make it past 10 episodes. And I think that's true because I've been on podcasts that I've done like 4 episodes then stopped. I even tried to do my own podcast in like early 2020 and did 3 episodes and went, I can't be bothered with this. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I
thing
can
is,
believe
everyone
that
thinks
statistic,
it's
absolutely.
Just, they think it's just turn up, press record, go, you know, and like, but yeah, you know, spoiler alert, there's a lot more to it than that.
There's a few of
so, yeah. Let's crack on.
Absolutely.
Question one, Christopher, please.
Question one. There's usually an interlude. We have no interlude. So question one it is.
All right.
This is, of course, directed at you, Philip, obviously. Okay. When do the gigs start getting better? And before you answer that, I think we should open that with a sub-question, which we can all discuss. What is better? Because is better you know, Philip, when did you start playing to more than 200 people, more than 500 people, more than 1,000 mm-hmm. people? When did you start earning a decent amount? When did you show up at a gig and an amp was provided to you? When did you show up at a gig and you were allowed a bass amp? You know, mm-hmm. like, these are all things that some would say is better. So let's figure out what better is, and then we'll go from there.
I think better is going to be, different depending on what your outlook is and what you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, of course, we all love to get paid for a gig, but there will be people out there, especially in like more original artists that aren't hiring musicians, perhaps, that are getting paid very little or next to nothing for gigs and are doing it because they want to do it. You know, so to those people, better is going to be, like, say, bigger crowds. I know that was it for me for a long time. It was I wanted bigger. And now I still do really want bigger crowds because mm-hmm. it's just more fun, I think, and I thrive off that energy a bit more.
Sure.
But then also now I actually get paid for gigs. Now I'm in a tribute band. It's crazy. Absolutely wild. Wild thought, get paid still to me. So for me, it's more about the bigger crowd still, I think. Our pace is quite consistent across gigs. So that's where I define it for me. Where are you sitting at with this, Philip?
Well, I'd love to hear, Chris, what do you think is better? What's your opinion?
It really varies because I'm a bass player for hire for mm-hmm. corporate bands. So mm-hmm. for me, I would say that's just income. So a better gig for me is more income, but also at the same time, the standard of what I'm doing increases. So let's say it's a, I don't know, it's a bigger band, it's a fancier package. The experience of the other musicians are greater than my own. So I'm almost like learning from the people I'm around. You know, let's say, like the band that I'm the first call bass player for have got some really experienced wedding musicians, you know, people have been doing it for a very long time mm-hmm. and they're very good. Some of them are session musicians for pretty high profile acts as well mm-hmm. but when those acts aren't on tour, they play the wedding scene. So for that, I would say it's mainly money / the learning opportunity. But then at the same time, though, I'm in my own originals band and we don't even think about money because it's just not there and it's not going to be there for a long time, and we're all okay with that. Mm-hmm. As long as as long as there's some money coming in to try and help with the expenses of running a band, happy days. Mm-hmm. But it's not always a given. So for that situation, it's the size of the crowd, the opportunity, the experience of maybe growing as a band or getting better as a cohesive unit. What else? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would just say, really, it varies massively. It depends on the reason why the bass is in my hand and whether it's going to be. Because everything for me is the three M's. It's mates, money, and music. Mm-hmm. And a project... And this has none of those. And a project has got to... A project for me has really, really got to have two minimum.
Yeah,
and I have bent that rule naively in the past. Yep. And every time I've bent it, I've paid the price in some way, either by having my time wasted or invested money in something that was ultimately not worth investing in. So now it's got to be two. Like, you can love the music, and you, like my band Darla, we'd love the music. We all get along super well. And yeah, the money's not there. But we're an unsigned originals act. You know, a set of independent artists. It's not going to be there. Whereas on a corporate gig, I really like the music I'm playing. Mm-hmm. The money's good. You know, everyone's fine. You know, I don't know these people, but we're a group of professional musicians. We don't have to be best friends.
Sure.
Let's do a job. As long as everyone's professional and nice... Mm-hmm. That's fine by me. But that's my set of rules. So that's kind of how I define it. It really depends on the situation, is what I'd say.
Yeah.
Sort of a non-answer, really. I'd make a great politician.
I mean, I think you guys covered it. Like, I agree with everything that you said. I'm reminded of the saying, what is it? Comparison is the thief of joy. Like, if you're comparing yourself to other musicians, it's always like, oh, well, they're doing this thing, and I'll have the better gig. I'll be successful when I do what they're doing. But they're doing that to the next person up the ladder, and it never stops. Like, it never will. So, like,
no.
I think, like, to say, hey, we have the opportunity to play music we enjoy with people that we enjoy playing music with and maybe make a little money. At any level, I think that's a huge win. But I also think that every working musician that I know is doing gigs that they don't want to do, right? In some level. Like, I'm reminded...
It is a job at the end of the day.
It is.
You can't have the best day at work every day.
Right. Well, and I'm reminded of a few years ago when I was playing pretty heavily in, like, a corporate band, and there was, like, this band where you get the email, and it would say, show up at this address at this time and know these 40 songs in these keys, and then there'd be no rehearsaling. You show up and you sink or swim. And that was the structure for the band. But what that meant is the gig, and you're there with musicians you never met before. And then, like, we'd be on the set break talking in between sets, and then I find out, oh, you used to play with Prince? Or, oh, you used to play with... You go on the road with the Count Basie Orchestra or whatever it is, like some heavy profile gigs, and now you're and now you're playing Brown Eyed with me at a town, and I'm not saying that to name drop because I didn't play with those people, but to talk about, okay, here's musicians that anyone would say are successful. You're playing with the best musicians in the world, but when you come off the road, you've got to make money still, right? So I think everyone is doing gigs that they don't want to do at some point if you're a professional musician. I think you lose your joy when you start comparing to other people. And I think you made a good point to make a distinction between, like, your working gigs, your corporate gigs, you're there to provide a service, and then there's also your more creative or fulfillment sort of gigs. I would call those successes in different ways. Right? When you're playing, and I'll say, if you're doing original music, especially, getting the better gigs, I think, is a moving target. Because you can try as hard as you want to and be excellent at music, doing original music, and you may never see that you imagine success being, even if you do everything right, because it's a moving target. The way the music industry works, you have to surgically and strategically climb a ladder, and the path that you take changes every year. With the way things are changing, with how the music business works. So you might do everything right and still not be successful. So I think what we have to decide is, what is success for us, right? Is it, how do we define success? And it's really hard to quantify that. So I think it depends. And I agree with everything you guys said.
Couldn't agree more. The comparison point, just to quit, I'll let you speak in a moment, Johnny, I'm sorry. I honestly could not agree with the comparison point. This rings true to me because I've spent a big chunk of this week, like, in my own head, comparing myself to people that I have either worked with previously, and we've just gone separate ways for various reasons. Nothing bad. They've got this gig, I've got this gig. I've got friends, like, really good friends, who are a bit more independent on the cover scene or the corporate scene. Because I'm 95% like a dep. I've got a pretty good reputation for being, like, the emergency bass player, which is good, but it means, like, if the main guy's fine, I don't get the job. That's kind of at the end of the day. So I play the comparison game in my head of going, oh, are they depping that gig to me, or have they given it to someone else because maybe they don't like me anymore, or did I say something maybe at the last gig? I don't know, I can't remember. And you go around, you make up stories in your head, and then, like I said, I've got peers who are on slightly different trajectories, and they've just hit a bit of a speed ramp, and they're in a good position. They've jumped a few steps up the ladder, they've got a gig with a band who are doing really well, and I'm like, I must suck. It must be that. There can't be any other reason. And that's not true. And also, again, comparison is the thief of joy. Another phrase I use is, when you play the comparison game, you lose every time. And it's absolutely true, because you never compare yourself to someone else and go, yeah, I'm doing better than them. Yeah. Oh, maybe if you're a raging narcissist, I don't know, but I don't do that. So I always lose the comparison game when I play it. So I could not agree more with those points. Absolutely.
Yeah. The comparison game just never helps you. It's never healthy for you, regardless of what you think about yourself as well, because then you start thinking, oh, well, they don't deserve that. And, like, it's just not a healthy mindset to ever be in when you're comparing yourself to other people.
Well, with music, it's like...
Great points.
You know, it's... In different careers, you can quantify success in different ways. It's like, oh, you went to medical school, and now you have your practice... Or you went to graduate school and now like there's like these like milestones of things that you can say
there's an A to B right. to C and music, to D trajectory.
Music it's not like that. So it's like I think we should celebrate a little more our wins where it's like, oh, I got paid to play this gig. Oh, I got to play with my best friends and we had a show that really connected with people and they felt it. Like those are wins. Mm. Those are absolutely wins and we like let them go and don't celebrate them as wins because we're like on to the next thing. So
yeah, like cool, but exactly. What about this?
Yeah. Reflection is so important to look back as well on what you've done before to see where you were and where you are now. Because we can often get lost in the foresight of like, well, and like you said, the target's always moving. And that's the case for your targets. Absolutely. And what you want to be doing in the future as well.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like, it can even drill down to tone chasing, you know, like you're never going to reach the end because you're like, great, I got it. Oh, but this, you know, and then your mind's just going to the next place. So it's the same for everyone, and I think it bring people a lot of comfort to hear that everyone's in that same kind of boat, everyone's chasing this same kind of thing and looking up mm-hmm. to that next person. I think that's
absolutely
that's a great
in fact
great,
there's thing to show. Are you too familiar with the Mark Manson book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a... Can we swear on this? I can't remember. The Subtle Art...
Fuck yeah, we can't.
There we go. The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, a.k.a. I haven't won the best books ever. There's a bit on comparison in that, and this guy, the art author, talks about a story about Dave Mustaine being fired from Metallica before Metallica started, and in his sort of rage and jealousy and kind of like I'm just out of spite, he forms Megadeth, and then in the book he talks about how Megadeth are one of the most successful heavy music bands of all time. They've sold over 24 million albums worldwide. They are a regular arena and stadium headlining band. But Dave Mustaine lives in a constant state of it's not good enough because he's always comparing himself to Metallica, who are the biggest metal band in the world. So he can't win, despite the fact that to virtually anyone else, the level of success he has achieved in his career is unbelievable. There'd be thousands of people who would like gnaw their own leg off to be where he is. But him internally, because he's lost himself to the comparison game, essentially, he's always like, oh, well, I headlined the second stage at Download last year. Wow, Dave, that's amazing. Yeah, but Metallica just did two nights this year. On the main
stage.
Do you know what I mean? It's like his level of success is unbelievable, and there are very few people who have ever gotten to his level. But he's obsessed with the arguably one of the only bands bigger than his. So again, it's like it's that whole thing about comparison being the thief of joy. Where you're at is probably pretty good, and I guarantee there's probably a lot of people who look at someone like me or Johnny and play the comparison game going, oh, well, they posted this on Instagram, so they must be having the best life ever, whereas we'll be sat internally going, oh, God, I wish I had more followers, or, oh, I'm only gigging once this week, or, oh, I only earned this much from this gig, and we're just obsessing over the next person up the ladder, and then they'll be obsessed with the person above them, and it just goes on and on and on until maybe at the top of the tree they think they're fine. Or maybe they think they have a different problem, like they're scared of losing where they are. You know, like, I'm the biggest band in the world. Oh, God, but that band just put out a really good album. Our album didn't do that good. Here we go.
Who's Taylor Swift looking up to?
That's what Taylor Swift's not looking at anyone. Taylor Swift's looking at Michael Jackson and going, I need to make sure I top that. Yeah. So she's reached
Queen
a point
of,
success. Exactly. Absolutely. She's probably reached a point of success where she's now comparing herself to people who, like, can't argue back.
You, Chris.
Essentially. Me, obviously.
Why can't I be in Wigan?
Oh,
I think excellent points raised all round, gents. The answer to the actual question being when do gigs get better? Never, apparently. Never. Because we always want the next thing.
Or,
so, nice and joyful.
It'll get better when you start thinking about
That's
it.
That's what I was
going
to say. Or maybe it already has been and you just haven't seen it that way. So yeah, just take a minute and say, hey, if you're playing music, it's a win. Yeah.
Basically, listeners, we are gaslighting you into getting a better attitude.
Hey,
stop being
is
so
such
emotional.
A place.
Well, and I do think I think it is really maybe. Important to have a distinction between creative fulfillment advice and career advice, because I recognize too, like,
100%.
You need to pay bills.
Yeah.
You need to succeed. If I would answer this question maybe differently if it's someone that they are full-time music and they are trying to have a healthy career, as opposed to they love music and they want to play more. I think those, I want to preface everything with those are different questions, and I think to dig into both of them would maybe be too much time to one or the other. But I think you have to define success for yourself, what your goals are and what you're doing.
For sure, for sure. Because often those are very different outcomes at the end and come at different costs sometimes,
absolutely.
Those things. Mm-hmm. Whether it's time or money that you're putting into something and how you get there.
Lovely. Absolutely.
Shall we move on to our second question, Chris?
Why the heck not?
I ain't scared.
You should be. We normally cut this part out while I open up my phone to read the questions, but here we are. We're keeping it real. So, question two. Philip had a hand injury. That's it. I'm kidding. Philip had a hand injury. What was your experience and advice around care and recovery from a first-hand perspective? I respect the pun. I really do respect the pun.
I love puns, and I also respect the pun. Yeah, that's a big question. We could go as deep as we want to on that. But specifically in terms of care and recovery, I would say two big things, two specific things. One is take the time to rest. If you are in physical pain and you're playing music and you're playing through the pain, I strongly believe that you need to stop and not do that, because you may create a long-term problem that you cannot undo. And I think that was one of my regrets, is I played too much too soon. At the time I was playing maybe 5 or 6 gigs a weekend, and then shedding a ton. I was playing a lot. I was playing a whole lot, and it was my primary source of income. And I felt this pressure to get back in there, and I jumped back in too soon, and I overdid it and developed scar tissue and arthritis in my left hand. It's basically this joint in my left hand, which, as you gents know, if you're a right-handed player, that's your fulcrum. That's like the strength of everything you do, is that joint right there. And I had twisted this. It just, it's never been the same. And that was, I don't know, six years ago now.
Oh, it's fine. Okay.
So I would say really take time to rest. And then also the second thing with that is be vigilant, religious with physical therapy if you have the opportunity to receive it. And I wish I'd been a lot more disciplined and made... It was expensive to have physical therapy, and money was tight, and I didn't do it.
Yeah.
If I'd done more of that, I feel like I would have had a more full recovery. So to the musician out there that may be struggling with an injury, if you don't hear anything else from me, take time to rest. Gigs will always be there. Opportunities will always be there, but your health might be compromised. And I will say, too, I did a video on my channel where I go through some more personal things of my experience with injury and identity and what I learned from losing something musically. And if you're dealing with something, I have a video on my channel where I go deeper into that. If you're struggling with that as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you guys want to check that out, click the links down in the description. If you're watching on YouTube or on Spotify as well, click the links in the description to check out Philip's channel. You can see all of that content and more. I think, like you said about physical therapy as well, like when someone thinks physical therapy, they'll think like big chiropractor cracking someone's back mm-hmm. or like doing yeah, big course, injuries, yeah. and they don't consider your hands to be...
Yeah.
Or they might think, oh, it's only my hands, don't need that.
And it's an extremely complicated, small piece of machinery, like the human hand. It's not just a, you know, it's not like a singular joint. It's a large connection of tendons and muscle tissue. And yeah, it's not an easy thing. And like, I've had physical therapy on my hip, because when I was 22, I was in a car accident. Just someone ran into the back of me, and something that was relatively simple. I remember having a good 12 weeks of like physical therapy for things like whiplash and kind of like learning stretches and just like how important it is to kind of go, you have injured this muscle and this section of your body. You need to make some active steps now to treat that. Otherwise, you know, I mean, I don't know what would happen if I just did nothing or went to the gym the next day, but you could have caused serious injury. And it's the same as like, you know, actual exercise in the gym, like no pain, no gain is a truly awful piece of advice. And the second you feel absolutely. Any pain, the second you feel any pain ever, like legit pain, like as in, ow, this hurts, you stop. And there is no, I understand maybe, oh, I'm, you know, I've been playing for 2 hours and my forearm is starting to ache a little bit. You know, that's one thing. But I mean, like, I can feel the joint is in pain right now. I am suffering. You absolutely should be stopping, because then you are risking serious damage.
Yeah.
Permanent serious damage as well.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, man.
Short-term gains are not worth the long-term.
No.
Yeah, I remember a moment. Distinctly, I was on a wedding gig, and there was a cocktail set where we played some like real book jazz, and like I was on there with some like some heavier jazz musicians, and they called some bebop tunes, was like, I remember sight reading and playing like fast quarter note walking jazz, and I remember like I went into the bathroom, like closed the door in tears in pain, just from trying to hang on the gig, And being afraid of, like, if I don't hang on the gig, am I going to lose my gigs? And the pressure I was putting on myself to be, like, I have to be excellent. I have to perform. But if I don't do that, am I going to lose my standing in the music scene or whatever it was? And I will say, too, that leads to one other thing I'll say. And I'll keep it brief. I think that injury helped me understand who my real friends are. And I don't mean that in a rude way, but in the music industry, we're all friends, right? We're all like, we're working together and we're all friendly with each other. But when I had that injury and I pulled back from playing, there was a lot of people that sort of wrote me off. And then there were some others that came alongside me and said, hey, if you never play bass again, I'm still your friend. And also, I should say too, my wife, who is just amazing through the whole thing. I think the injury, the experience of the injury helped me understand who the most important people in my life were. Because I think it's easy to think everyone's your friend in music world, but it's all work, you know, even though we have these built-in friendships with playing music at a high level. So it's something that I learned, and I think the most important thing in your life is the people that actually truly care. I know that sounds a bit cheesy, but I think it's true. And that was one win from it, was learning that. Sorry, I know this is a bit heavy. I'm dropping like some heavy stuff.
But, oh, no.
But it's true.
This is nothing.
We need something to bring us back down.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So sorry for all the heavy vibes, but that question I can't just like phone it in. Like, that's a very real thing that a lot of musicians deal with, you know? Like, I think at some point, every serious working musician will in some way deal with some sort of thing, injury that will, or arthritis or carpal tunnel or something that will affect your ability to do what you do. And what do you do when you can't do the thing that is what you do? How do you handle that? And I think that's something that all of us will have to deal with at some time. And it's not fun, but I think there's a lot that can be learned from that. So,
Absolutely. And I think you raised a really good point there about the part about sort of like friends, like you know who your friends are. Because as you can probably imagine, when you work freelance, you need to be friends with the people you work with. It's kind of that. It's not like, you know, I've had office jobs where I cannot stand people on my team. They don't like me either. But there's a hierarchy involved of, well, we're contractually obliged to work together. Get over it. Whereas in a more freelance,
are you talking about this podcast?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I used to, for some context, I worked in sales for years before I worked as a musician. And you get a lot of people who've watched The Wolf of Wall Street and think that's literally it. And yeah, I've got sales cracked now. And it's not very nice people. But when you're in a freelance environment like this, or like you're a musician for hire, you know, you could do a gig and you could say one thing, which isn't objectively like a problem, but it might just be that person was having a bad day and they're in charge about whether you get repeat business from them. So they could go, he made that joke about Metallica and I don't like Metallica. Let's just not book him again. And it can be as, I've heard it about other people where they've said, oh, he said this, so now we'll just get someone else. And I'm like, that's it? That's such a small margin of, you know what, maybe not.
Yeah.
But then pressure happens, like, yeah, absolutely. You've got to be on like your best behavior. And then especially I gig with so many people that I've never met before until that day. And like, as you may have realized, I'm a very chatty person and often talk a little bit too much. So I'm like, where's the line here? Is this going to be this? I'm chatting to this guitarist before the set. Is he going to find it weird if I ask him a question about the set? Because I've just got a very normal question like, hey, I Want You Back by Jackson 5. It's got that crazy bass line in the bridge. I did a gig last week and the guitarist played it, or the keyboard played it. Should I do it or do you want to take it? Or, you know, that kind of thing. And they could be like, oh, great, yeah, and we'll talk about it and it's fine. Or, and I've had this, they could be like, give like a really weird answer and then walk off. And you would, I've been in that situation and gone, well, what happened there? And then you kind of think that person doesn't like you for the rest of the day. And it's so small. And the point I was swinging back around to was when you mentioned about the injury, it was almost like a, friendship means very little when it's convenient, I think. That's a quote from John Wick. But it's true, though. It's like if you're a great person to be around and there's something in it for them, if they're your friend, you're on the up in your career, people are going to be your mate. People are going to be your friend. It's not a problem at all. But if you're down and out, you know, maybe you've been ill, you've had an injury, something personal's come up and you might not necessarily want to or can take gigs, you see very quickly who's like bothered around you, as in your friendship is enough for them to have a reason to interact with you. Whereas Philip's got an injury now, so I don't need him to play bass on my album, so I don't really see why I need to talk to him.
Yeah. Yeah. Which can happen. I mean, you nailed it. And it's that can be exhausting because as a freelancer, if you're a freelance musician, so your income is determined by your musical opportunities. And then your hang abilities determine your musical opportunities, then you have to always be on. Mm. And then it creates this false expectation of always being 100% cool and easy to deal with. And also, too, I'll say, I know that bridge that you mentioned, and that reminds me, too, and this is more a little of a bass player-y thing, but like I've had that, too, where it's like, okay, we're about to go live, and there's an uncertain musical moment So should I discuss it or should I go with the flow? And I think a lot of musicians would go with the flow, but as bass players, we are the flow, right? So it's like,
yeah,
when you, yeah, the root note of the chord, everyone's going to hear that and say, this is where we are. But in those moments, the bass player can become the band leader, essentially. But if the bass player doesn't know what the singer or the actual band leader wants to do, it can be seen as a mistake. So then you're in a difficult position of, do I ask a question that may someone vibe me for, or do I just leave it up to the moment? And sometimes there's not a right answer to that. What do I do in a moment
it's
like
very,
that?
It's a very difficult sort of like...
Because the bass is so powerful.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Those moments I just hit the tuner, pretend something has gone wrong.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Genius.
Oh, no.
I'm going to do that at my gig tomorrow.
I had some... Sorry, please. I had somebody in a music exam once...
Exams.
They.
It's not very punk rock. Says the man with a music degree, but fair enough.
He had his performance part, and he was doing the rhythm, and there was also another guitarist in there, and he did the entire exam with his volume rolled off, and he got like top marks. He was just like miming the whole thing, and they were like, "Yeah, this guy, great job."
In my final year performance exam at university, it was in a bar right by the university, which is where they got the ensemble bands together. Because I did like contemporary music, so it was all like pop session work and rock stuff. So there was no classical stuff. So a performance was quite important. The judges' table, if you will, which is where the head of music, the course leader, and they had like a guest judge in, was marking it. I said to my lecturer, I'm going to stand on the table during the guitar solo in this piece. And he went, he looked me dead in the eye and went, if you do that, I'll fail you. Guess what I did?
Failed.
Stood on the table. I got 87%. Wah!
Shall we move on to our next segment?
Let's do just that.
Marvelous. I'm so used to having an interlude there that I'm now expecting to hear some funky tunes and bass slapping going on.
It is really strange. It's almost like the interlude now is 5 seconds of awkward silence and then one of us going, let's move on to this.
Can't be bothered to edit that in. Oh yeah, whoops. Low effort content. Woo!
I mean, it is weirdly in trend.
Yeah, very true. Very true. this segment is one of my favorite segments. It's called That Tone You Own. Every time we have a guest on, we like to let them showcase their kind of signature sound, or maybe even just a tone that they're enjoying at the minute, or on a recording that they've done that they particularly enjoyed their tone on. So you can talk about the gear that went into it, why decisions were made, etc., etc. Lovely Philip Conrad has brought along a track for us to listen to. Philip, before we press play, do you want to set it up? What have we got here to listen to?
Sure. Well, briefly, this is my band, Noah Gut, Good Trouble. It's a release called Rockstar. And maybe it's something that all of us could relate a little bit to. It's inspired by the sort of disenchantment of the music industry, but how it's still worth it to try and be creative. So that's kind of the background of the song. Light starts to fade. And,
well, Philip, that sounded awesome. Props to your singer, by the way. What a voice. What a set of pipes on that boy.
Yeah, Noah so can good. Sing, man. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so Noah's a good friend of ours, and yeah, he can sing.
Awesome. And you can play as well, because
thanks.
That bass was sounding so full and so good. Before you tell us what was going on in there, I do have a prediction. And
okay,
I might be totally wrong on this, but my ears were giving me like short scale vibes. Was there a short scale being played on there?
Maybe, but but guess be a little more specific.
Oh no! Well, if you said maybe to a short scale, then perhaps it was a medium scale. You know, I could really hear that 2 inches coming off that full scale bass.
Bet you could.
It's not about speaking feeling of, those 2 inches.
I actually have a medium scale video on the way, so stay tuned for that. But it is a short scale, but it's not the Mustang.
Ah, interesting.
That's a clue.
Hmm.
Ooh.
Interesting. Is it a bass that you
now
own?
I'm going...
It is.
Yes.
It is.
I don't know what basses he owns.
Is it a semi-hollow?
I'm just going to make up...
It is a semi-hollow.
Oh.
It's a Hofner.
Nope. You want me to show you?
Yes, please.
Yeah, go on then. We've gone video for a reason.
All right. It's old Snorlax.
Oh, my God.
Of course.
Look at that.
So, this is... Did you see the video about this that I did?
Yeah, I did.
Maybe. If not, no worries. It's
yeah.
It's so this is a bass that doesn't exist. This is one of a kind. That's why you can't guess what it is. So this is it used to be an Epiphone signature bass. The it had two humbuckers, mini humbuckers, and it was like I bought it for $200. Like 10 years ago. And I totally stripped it down and replaced everything on it and put a Curtis Novak Darkstar clone pickup in here, which is the same one cloning the same thing that's in like the Guild Starfires. Old school pickup.
Okay.
So this is like a bass that there's only one of. And then the combination is that with the fuzz pedal that I was playing. The fuzz pedal being... there's this really cool company. I'm going to mispronounce it. Kazlitter. It's a guy in the Czech Republic that hand makes these pedals. And he just made this slamming fuzz pedal that I really like called the Albatross. And he like hand makes them in his garage. So it's this bass with that fuzz is that tone. So it's a combination of the sort of like Dark Star clone pickup with a subtle fuzz. And then I played with a pick. I used that big stubby pick, the 3mm. But the trick is, I used not the pointy side, I used the round side. It was that combination of things that made that sound.
Nice. What do you find about the rounded side of the pick that like helped in that situation?
I find that it's less clacky, like it's less attack, it's less focused, it's like a little closer to fingers, but it still has that like here's the note sort of thing. So yeah, just try it. Like if someone listening hasn't tried it, like just, I don't have a pick with me, so I won't use the SD card again. But yeah, using that the rounded part, not the pointy part of the pick, and you get a different sort of tone out of it. So worth trying.
Nice.
And I will
I'm
say too,
try on, that now.
On that, I think I saw in Martin, that's where I saw that. But on that big stubby, it's like a thicker pick that is like, it's a lot larger than like a traditional guitar pick. So that's part of it. It's not just rounded 2D, it's rounded 3D, right? That's part of where that sound is coming from. It's not just a thin
piece. Yeah, it's got quite a unique shape, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of, yeah.
It's not just a flat.
It tapers.
Thing. Exactly.
Yeah. I have used one like mm-hmm. a very like a long time ago.
It's like
so
that.
I'm familiar with it. I'm.
It's that purple one. It's the big stubby, and I think it's the 3mm one.
Yeah.
So those.
It is. It's a Dunlop 3mm.
Exactly.
Big stubby.
Yeah, it's that's kind of my primary pick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I kind of want to get one and try and play like my band's tunes. On it for record, my band is like a very like heavy post-hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
It's very heavy band,
mm-hmm.
And I use a Dingwall NG2
mm-hmm.
in Drop A,
and
it's a very like, it's pretty gnarly. And the reason why I use a thinner pick is because I can wallop the living crap out of the string,
mm-hmm.
and that plus the extended scale length of the neck. And the strings means I'm you know, I have like definition and mid range in such a low tune as opposed to it just being all flubby. But I kind of want to try the big stubby just for a laugh. It might be good. I don't think it will be, but I kind of want to do it for a joke.
I think it'd be cool. I think I like that pick, and also the like the palm thing, like playing the pick down here with a semi hollow.
Oh, yes.
And the semi-hollow with a fuzz that's, like, not overtly fuzzy, like, slightly fuzzy. That is a really fun sound. It's fun
vibe.
It's fun to play. For, like, super heavy music,
yeah.
I don't know if it's the move.
You've got plenty of warm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it'd be an awful move.
Yeah, semi-hollow with the subtle fuzz in the pick is, like, one of my favorite things.
I mean, if you want to do a cover of one of my band songs with that tone... I would find that quite amusing, but yeah, of course. But it's a different. We were talking about it earlier, weren't we? About like different tools for different vibes. Like
absolutely.
For this Noah Guthrie tune, you might get some raised eyebrows if you showed up with an active five string, and a quad cortex and a dark glass head and stuff like that. Whereas if you were subbing my gig with my band and you showed up with all that stuff, it'd be like, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Different tools for different jobs at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think like that's part of the fun of recording is you can like really go down the rabbit hole of like what does this song need, and you can use some kind of weird bass that if you showed up on a corporate gig with that weird bass, like it would be totally inappropriate because it's not versatile. It might sound good on one song out of the 10, whereas if you show up to your like working gig, you're probably going to show up with your P bass or your J bass or your Stingray. Because they're more, you can get a variety of sounds out of them. So that's one thing that I love about recording is getting to lean into those like idiosyncrasies of like, what does the song need? And then you can do something weird.
Yeah, I have a question regarding that actually. When you were recording,
mm-hmm.
how much time would you say you spent on the recording of the bass? And more importantly, for my question. This sort of exploration of, well, let's try this bass, let's try this bass, let's try this pedal, let's try with a pick, let's try not.
Mm-hmm.
How much time did you get? Because a lot of my experience in a studio environment is like, get it out and play it. Like, get it tracked tight, done almost. But that's because I'm working to, you know, very tight budgets as like an independent artist. So how does that vary for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it really depends. Like I've done work as a session bass player for artists that hire me, where it's like, okay, we're doing 10 songs today. Time is of the essence. You listen to it, you chart it, you track it, and we move on. There's that workflow, and in that workflow, it's like very like time is very important, and accuracy is important, and there's not a space for exploration. This specific recording was with my band, and it was at Rhett's house, who is the guitar player, and we're on our own time, it's not like a traditional like session work thing. And but even there, you know, we are trying to be efficient with time, so it's like we're working through the song, we're working through the arrangement a few times, and everyone is, okay, let's try a different snare drum on this, let's try a different guitar, let's try a different amp. Everyone is searching to find it, and then you find that sound, and then the arrangement locks in, and then once everyone sort of agrees on what it is, we go listen once to play back to make sure all the sounds are working, and, you know, everything's communicating. I'm trying to remember if we did that to tape or not. I think that was to Pro Tools. But we try and, like, do all of our outboard stuff live, running through compression and EQ, not digitally. Commit to something. That's something that's really important to me, is we live in a digital era where you can have option anxiety. You can record something and then manipulate it later and have infinite options. But there's something really nice about committing to an idea and saying, this is how it sounds and we're going to print it that way. And then you have to move on. So we try to... So I think we spent a few takes to kind of just find it. And then we took a couple takes to get the performance. And we didn't track to... Like, we don't track to a click. We track analog. More recently, we've been tracking to tape. But I think on this specific... I think we all tools. And then just commit to it and call it done. It's a different work.
Were there any... sounds you experimented there that you, you know, that you didn't land on, or something that didn't work for this recording?
This one's all into place. It had the riff, and we were like, let's record it, and then we did. So this one was fairly fluid in that. I think for me personally, I usually, it's more finding the right part than it is finding the right bass. And that can be elusive, because finding that part may depend on what the drummer's doing or what the guitar is doing, and you sort of all as a unit have to find it together as a band, right? Because maybe the kick pattern is going to determine what bass line could work. As a bass player, what I try to do is find this magical, elusive part that will take what everyone else is doing and tie it together, where you can create something that glues it. And sometimes that can be elusive. And sometimes you have to, like, work together as a band to find parts that can make it possible for it to all lock together. So sometimes you have to talk with the drummer or talk with the guitar player about a voicing or something. But usually I try and listen to everything that's happening and say, what's the perfect thing that could tie this together, and then try to find that. And sometimes it falls right into place, and sometimes it takes a few times. And then from there, once the part is determined, then I'm starting to think about tones and say, maybe the flat wounds aren't working on this, or maybe we need a fuzz, or maybe I've been messing around with spring reverb recently with a pick, which has been kind of cool to get that kind of Western sort of sound. That can be cool. It's like a moving target, and each song in each band, I think, is different with that.
Yeah.
I completely forgot that I've seen videos where you've done it at Rhett's house, either on your YouTube channel or his YouTube channel. I just completely forgot, because in my head I was thinking, how many days did they pay for to mess around with fuzz pedals? Because can I do that? Because I never get to do that. A lot of my stuff is like, we are tracking five songs in 5 days, and it's not songs you can just wing. It's like technical music. So it's like, we're spending 2 days on guitars, 2 days on drums. Okay, one afternoon for all of bass. And it's like, go.
Yeah.
Which you obviously have the experience of doing.
Yeah, I mean, I've done it both ways, and that's cool too. You know, there's something cool about that, where it's like, okay, we got to go, we got to get this, you got to be efficient. I do think more recently, there's been a few bands that I've been recording this way, where it's like, we rehearse it, and then the whole thing is live tracked to tape with no click, with the vocal printing, and like, it's takes some time to get the right take. Maybe it's 3 to 5 takes to get the right one, but there's something really freeing about just saying like, okay, we did it and it's done and we're going to move on. We can maybe tweak a little bit in the mix, but we've made all our decisions and we have to just go with what our decisions were. And that is a really freeing creative place, I think.
That's probably where a lot of creative ideas end up coming from. Because it's like, well, we can't overthink this or decide that we don't like this. We're going to change that and do this and micromanage every single part. You know, you really got to, right, this is it. Move on.
Yeah, this is the tale. So,
Well, and I think having some
limitations can
exactly like we've been recording. We just recorded with another band, Roofman, at Rhett's, and we recorded the whole thing to a 388, which is a tape machine that has 8 tracks. So it's like, how do you rate inputs? So you have to compromise on some things, you know. But then, like with those limitations, it's like, well, we're going to use one. We're not going to do stereo guitars. We're going to do one. You know, a guitar, and then we're gonna have one on the acoustic guitar, and that leaves, you know, I think you like when you have a problem, the solution becomes clear, and that informs your creative process. So something similar that I've done on my channel is the tiny song concept. I don't know if you've seen any of those, but it's like I'll take a concept or an experience and then try and create a piece of music that is 100% inspired by that thing. And it's freeing creatively because then I'm not worrying about what anyone thinks or what's cool or what are other musicians going to think. All I'm thinking about is I'm creating music that's inspired by this thing, and every decision is 100% focused on that. It's very freeing to have limitations because then the decisions are sort of made for themselves and you don't have that option anxiety.
Yeah, it's like
I absolutely love
I can't try this, I can't try that, I can't try this, I can't try that. I can only do that one or that one, and one of them has to work. There's no... But yeah, 8 tracks seems easy, so we'll do DI, we'll do the bass amp, we'll do distorted bass as a separate channel. Maybe we do like a low end, a high end. Maybe I'll take a pass on like a synth. What about you, Johnny? Octave down, maybe? Octave up?
It's amazing.
That's 7. And short scale.
Printed.
Yeah, they've got 8. Done. Easy.
I think that's amazing. I think that, like, it's being able to... It all links back, I think, when you talk about when you're recording with those guys and taking a step back, listening to what they're doing, and then applying yourself in the sound that you want based on the song as well. And that can... really lead to some creative things that you wouldn't have necessarily thought. And putting the song first, like we all should do, and not, because I often make a mistake when I go in going, I want my tone to sound like this, and it's going to sound great, and I think it sounds great, but does that sound great for the whole benefit of it all, you know? Being able to take that step back, listen to what everything else do, and find that pocket of you know, where you should be sat to glue it all together is a much better perspective.
Yeah, I think when I first started recording a lot, I think one of the mistakes that I made was asking too many questions. I'd ask the engineer, like, oh, do you like this or this? And they're like, they're thinking about the drum sounds. You know, like, I think being self-sufficient in the studio and making your decisions... And if there's a problem, you'll hear about it. You definitely will. But the questions that I will ask will not be like, hey, should I use the bass or the P bass or the tone? I self-monitor things. And if it's a problem, I will ask is I'll ask the songwriter, hey, what does the song feel like to you? And then they'll tell me the story of the song or the sentiment of the song. And then as a musician and reverse engineer, like, okay, what would that sound like as a bass part? So, like, those are the sort of questions that I'll ask. I don't want to be micromanaged. I want to be self-sufficient with the decisions that I'm making and then make those sort of communication points be more creative if necessary. Those are the questions I'll ask.
Also, translation as well. I feel like if you as the bass player or me or Johnny as the bass player said to the artist, what do you want? They might have absolutely no idea what the difference is between a Music Man and a P bass. And they may accidentally, just through their own lack of knowledge, and that's fine, they're not a bass player, they're a let's pretend they're just a singer, you know, let's say they don't, or they just play piano, but they don't have that knowledge of that specific instrument, and they come in
right
confident saying to you, I want a P bass, I want this and I want that, because they've just seen somewhere that a P bass and a DI is the best tone ever, and they've decided that's that. You'll then do that because they've hired you to do as you're told,
right?
And then they are dissatisfied with the product because they go, oh, this isn't right. Whereas if they'd said to you, oh, I want it to sound a bit like, oh, I don't know, let's say they've said, oh, I like Guns N' Roses, I want this kind of like, mm-hmm. I want this kind of like Duff McKagan tone. You would then go, well, I would go, okay, so it's not a P bass with flats. It's not a DI. Mm-hmm. We need a bright bass. We need rounds, and we need like an SVT. We need kind of like we need an amp tone with a bit of grit. So the point I was making was, you are translating the information. They've given you information. They've given you a brief, and you've gone, okay, I will now hit the brief. Whereas if you'd ask too many questions that they won't know the answers to, you may just get the wrong information, and as a result, a worse product.
Exactly. Yeah, that's where I agree. Where it's like, don't ask too many questions. Be self-sufficient with your decisions. And that's actually something that in that conversation with Tim Pierce the other week that he told me. At the end of the day, it all goes back to the producer and or artist, and you have to yield to their vision. But like, he's worked with some of the best producers in the world, and one of the points that he made to me was like, some of these great producers, really, it's about just putting the right people in the room and letting them make decisions. Like, get a great band in a room of people that can make mature decisions without an ego, then it's going to sort itself out. So that's the goal, is how do you become one of those people?
Yeah.
People that can make their musical decisions with maturity, humility, without an ego, but also in alignment with the vision of the creative force behind the song in a way that's empowering them and not fighting them. It's like, they've given you a black and white photograph and you're going to help them add the color, you know, and you are choosing how to do that, and they're trusting you to do it. How can you do that in a way that you can earn that trust?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I feel like I, every episode, learn stuff, and this has been incredible for me so far. Someone that predominantly is a live musician now. It's been ages since I've been in. I record at home all the time, but not in like a studio situation. It makes me want to go out and record some studio stuff now, honestly. And not, you know, a lot of people might be afraid of jumping in the studio. So I hope people can take a lot from this and learn from it, especially if they're going in for the first time or even from experience. I think that's great.
Well,
to pass on.
Johnny, if you
we're talking so much about recorded tone.
Well, Johnny, if you ever want any advice, all you just got to do is ask me. You know, I'm just a phone call away. I fumbled that joke so hard as well. I'm absolutely gutted. On that point, though, that you said, Johnny, the studio can be a super not intimidating environment. It can be super comfy. You can feel like there's no wrong answers. If you're in the right environment with the right people, it's just a free space for you to work and create and create a good product. At the same time, the studio can be like just like a horrible place. Like I've had both. Like I've had super fun, enjoyable recording experiences where I've come away and had a great time, and then I've had other studio experiences where I have been like driven down to the bone unnecessarily by people. Almost again as like an ego problem, and you've come out the studio going, I suck. Like, I'm really, really not good at this instrument. Should I even come back tomorrow? You know, that kind of thing. But it all depends on the environment, especially the people you work with, I find. Absolutely. It can really make or break the room.
For sure. I think now is a good time for us to move on to our next and final question that we've got, because it kind of ties into what we're talking about. So I think it'd be nice... nice segue to transition.
It absolutely does. We always segue this
I know.
Well, you guys are smooth.
Smooth operators. That's what all of we want our reviews to be. Just like, these guys are so smooth. These smooth British blokes.
Absolutely.
Speaking of smooth, how's that question looking, Chris?
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Well, it's not really a question, is it? It's a debate.
Oh, it's a debate.
It's a big base debate. It's a good one, this, and I feel like Philip is the perfect person to discuss it, and it does tie into what we just spoke about. So, for you, and kind of all of us to an extent, what is more important, your live tone or your recorded tone?
That's a tough one. Does anyone want to?
And I think it would also. I think we should. Well, we'll let Philip start. But I think.
What do you guys
think? Also, it should be a. I think what's more interesting is also. What's the difference between your live? Because what the tone you use. Like I've even with my own band, the tone we recorded, is not the tone I'll be using live. Yeah, it's similar, but it's not the same. Cause it's not going to work. And why, etc. I think that's kind of the point, I feel.
Mm-hmm. If you were to look at it from a black and white point of view, you know, a recorded tone is forever. You know, it's there to stay. People listen back to it. It's there. It's on the recording. A live tone, though, I don't know. What is going to be more impactful? You know, when you're going to hear something live. For me, you know, I play with I say quite a lot of drive. A lot of my drive is coming from me playing and absolutely just smacking the strings when I'm playing like the Foos and Nirvana stuff. And I have like some light distortion on there as well. And for me, I want certain sections to be like, oh, wow, that sounds thick. That sounds huge in those bits. So for me at the minute, I mean, I'm in a primarily live performance scenario at the minute. So at the minute, I'm in the live tone camp, where that's where I want to impress people. But then I can see it from both sides. We've spoken in length about recorded stuff there. Chris, where are you landing at the moment? Because you are very much mixing it up, and I've had that recording session fairly recently, I suppose, with Darla, although it probably feels like forever ago now.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was actually January when we recorded the tracks, but yeah.
So what is your, like, if you're approaching that band, so you are translating the recorded to the live.
Yeah.
What's your kind of thought process?
I think when you're with recorded sounds, you have the opportunity to be more like a scalpel, maybe like a bit more precise with, you know, maybe certain EQ moves, like, you know, oh, we're going to do a little notch here, we're going to do a little thing here, we're going to, you know, these kind of things. You can cascade it into multiple compressors and you can do so much more. But then when it comes to live, for me, I think a lot of that just disappears into the ether. Like, I think if I was playing on stage with a band, and I was like, hey guys, did you notice there's a 2 decibel boost at 2.61 kilohertz with a Q of 1.5? I genuinely think if you sat there A-B-ing it with a drum kit going, you're like, on and off, no one would notice. So I think with a live sound, this is before I get into like things like sound engineering, with a live sound, it's like, if you need to make a move, it needs to be a big move. Because in the sort of chaos of the live environment, it's too small, it's not going to be noticeable. And then alongside that, I think depending on, I don't know whether this will be one way or the other, but I tend to find maybe my live tone has less low end in it than a recorded tone. Because if you're doing a whopping great big boost to 80 hertz live, and depending on the room you're in, that could either sound fantastic or just really, really bad. Whereas recorded, because it's more of a controlled environment, again, it really just depends contextually over what you're doing. Like, I would say, so when I play a wedding compared to when I play with Darla, the amount of mid-range and the amount of treble in the bass tone is completely different. So when I'm doing a wedding, it's more of a, you know, it's more of a warmer, more of a warmer tone with less high end. It's more about kind of sitting under the guitars, but not in the way of the drums, and being very supportive. And maybe if there's a particular song where there needs to be treble, I've added in like a preset to accommodate for that on my pedal board. But with Darla, it's a very contemporary, like, metal tone. You know, there's a crossover, there's loads of distortion, there's loads of, like, it's like a clean low end. But there's not loads of low end, again, because then you're dealing with those sound engineering problems of it being too boomy, which I think a lot of bass players can be victim of. So, yeah, there is a difference.
Mm.
And I think the main thing for me is, in the studio, you can be more precise. Little moves will go a long way. Whereas on stage, in my experience, it's like, oh, you need to be making like bigger, more broad strokes because there's just not that space in the PA for little teeny weeny moves that are going to take a few minutes. It's almost like, need more mid-range in the bass. It's okay. Right, well, the mids are going up. That's it. There isn't a... Let me sweep it and find the right one. It's like, get the amp and turn the mid-range up. Is that fine, yes or no?
Crank it.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's my experience. Like, Philip, what about you?
Yeah, I agree with you guys both. There's some really true things there. I think when you are recording, you are creating a moment that lasts forever. And when you're playing live, you're creating a moment that happens only once. Yes. And both of those things are precious, right? Being in it, like when you're playing live, there's a performance and it's gone. And the only people that experience are the ones that are there. And there's something really special about that. And then in the studio, you can sit there and tinker. And if the budget allows, you can try different things and find the secret sound that can bring a song to life. I think... I try to approach them similarly. I agree. I think I'm going to be more inclined to EQ, because especially if it's like a gig where there might not be a front of house engineer and the band is sort of
self-engineering,
supplying their own sounds, self-engineering, then you have to take it upon yourself to be a little more surgical with your EQ and look for the problem frequencies and make sure you're not too boomy and cut some low end or whatever you have to do in the room. I think, your decisions live, I think, are more surgical and utility decisions.
Yeah,
it's like, how do we make...
That was the word I was looking for. It's kind of like there's a lot more of like utility-based, like acoustic decisions, mm-hmm. whereas in a studio environment, that's not really a problem. So you can just make creative moves.
Or if it is a problem, you have someone to help you, which is the engineer. And
yeah,
in
and
the
so
stu-
much more equipment potentially as well.
Yes, and drastic decisions in EQ or compression are things that I will tend to discuss with the engineer because I want to let them do their job too. So I'll give them a wide full sound that they can sculpt. And if live, I will say, how can we make the band sound as good as it can? These are the inputs. This is what's live. I'm going to choose what needs to happen here on my bass tone and make it happen. So I think some of it is showing some respect to... I mean, in the same way, live, if it's at a venue where there's a front house engineer, I don't want to step on their toes either. I don't want to do a lot of drastic EQ there either. So I think it depends on the situation. But I think the biggest difference is, I think the studio, you have a little more space and freedom to be creative. And in the and maybe try some unconventional equipment. You can mess with weird tube amps and weird pedals and do these things that might not be quite as practical if you have a long set on a stage, where those sort of decisions, maybe even with the equipment that I would choose for a three-hour gig, would be totally different decisions than what I would choose to record in the studio.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very good points there, as always.
Yeah, and it's like... the tools you use can really come into that as well, because like say for a sound within the studio, I might record something that is a lot more, I don't know, like something free for them to use and sculpt around, whereas live I might use something with more compression on it, or you know, or vice versa. It depends on the people you've got around you and their know-how and what they can do with what you have. You know, some sound engineers might want just a DI.
Yeah,
something very simple that they can then mold to their heart's content.
And those people and then... are evil.
Yeah, in my line of work, not welcome. But you know, and they know what they're doing. They could sound great with that. And I think the tools that you bring to each of those scenarios can very much depend on that as well. You know,
yeah,
all of this is subjective. We have to press it all with, it's all subjective based on what you're doing and the scenarios you find yourself in.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it really does depend on the situation. Like I've done a lot of weddings where there happens to be the budget for a sound engineer, which is unheard of, but here we are. Where we've had a bit of time where I've maybe had about, I don't know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes to kind of where I can sit with the sound engineer and go, turn the compressor on and off. What do you think? Is it, is it helping? Is it not? You know, here's the cab sim. And I remember I did a wedding a couple of weeks ago where I was like, that was the best live tone I've personally ever had. And all we did was turn the cab sim off on the amp sim that I was using. And the front of house engineer, he just did a little bit like, you know, I think he maybe cut it at like 65, cut it at the top at about 3K, did a couple of mid-range moves, and I could hear it in the in-ears, and I was like, this is genuinely the best it's ever sounded. And all I did was take a thing away. That essentially, you know, a cab sim is a very specific EQ curve. I took that away and gave him a much more flatter signal.
Yeah.
Basically the sound of a preamp that was already compressed. And he just tucked it the way that suited him for the room. It sounded fantastic. But then again, a similar example, playing in my originals band, I don't think there's any way you could convince me to turn the cab sim off because it's a lot of distortion and distorted. A distorted DI doesn't sound... It's an interesting sound, basically, but it's not really a sound I would want for that show. But then again, if we had a big, long sound check and they went... Can we just try turning it off? I'd turn it off. We'd give it a go. And if it didn't work, it didn't work. We'd go back to the original. I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm not doing that. I refuse. You know, you can't make me. Because at the end of the day, let's be honest, I don't think anyone in the crowd is going to go, this sounds really great. However, he's not got a cab sim on the bass tone, so I'm not having a good time.
Right.
I think it's all, you know, linked to... that thing again of what sounds good in the band scenario in the mix and what you think sounds good to yourself, because I bet if you soloed that bass, you would never choose that tone in a million years and you'd be like, this is way too quacky or this sounds bad.
I've since gone back and listened to it and gone, do not like it on its own, but then I'll play along with something at home, like a track that I've taken the bass out of, and I'm like, it just fits. It just sits perfectly. But then you solo everything and go, it doesn't sound like there's any low end. It's honky. There's like it's a bit too clacky in the finger department. And then you drop it back in the mix and go, perfect. All makes sense.
Yeah.
Live, there's a lot of things that go into it, and knowing what tools to bring along to be able to shape your tone in a way to fit that whole mix, you know, can be quite important.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things for me in my progress over the years has been not caring as much what I sound like isolated and saying, how do I sound in an ensemble? Because a lot of times something sounds really bad by itself, and in a mix it sounds amazing. And that's true of classic records. Like, go listen to isolated tracks of songs that you love, and you hear a tone by itself and you're like, I don't like the way that sounds, but then it sounds magic in a mix.
Absolutely.
And one other thing too, on the studio versus live thing, you can tell a difference between great live musicians and great studio musicians. This is a theory I have based off of something that they'll reveal. If you bring great live musicians and they try and play in the studio, one of the tells that they have is they don't leave any space for overdubs. Because live, there are no overdubs. You take up all the space that's there. And you play, you listen to the things that you can hear, and you fill in the space accordingly. And sometimes, like I was talking earlier, like, you record in such a way where everything that you record in the moment is all that there's going to be, but usually there's overdubs. So a lot of times I'll record drums and bass together with a scratch vocal, and then from there they'll build guitars and keys off of, and then they'll get the lead vocal, and then they'll get the main vocals, and then they'll do percussion, and then they'll do auxiliary keys, and like... they might add more and more and more things.
Oh,
so
right.
You have to leave space for things that you can't hear yet. And I think that's one of the shortcomings of green studio musicians that play a lot live, is they don't leave space for the things that they can't hear. And then when people try and overdub later, there's no room.
I mean, I would fall for that 100%. You know, if you I do considerably more live work than recording work, just way more. And if I had to go into a studio, I would not actively think, hey, maybe they're going to put a keyboard on this, or maybe the guitarist is going to want to take like a little bit of a lick in here, because I'm used to playing in a live environment where it's almost like I see gap, fill gap, you know, fill right. gap tastefully. I'm not saying every sure. 8 bars there's a 5 string double thumb sweep arpeggio, because I can't do
yeah.
that, obviously. Yeah. But it's like a, you know, if there's a gap or there's a fill, it's like I'm gonna think about that fill and approach it. Whereas in the studio, it might be like a, okay, well, you know, I'm not gonna play there. I'm gonna stop,
right?
Because they're gonna put something in, and then worst case scenario, we'll get to the end of the day, and they'll go, can you just grab your bass a second? Like, I just really think it needs bass for that one bar fill, just at the end, you know, that kind of thing. And you, mm-hmm. I mean, you could jump back in, but if you've already yeah. committed and they don't have time to go, Philip, can you just play all of this album again and just do less? That's just not going. It's not going to happen. There's not enough time and if for you, that.
And if you get that talk, you've already lost all future gigs at
you're
that studio.
Trouble. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's like if you're tracking bass and drums live together to a scratch vocal and an acoustic guitar, there's so much space, right? You can play
loads
like
of space,
and it won't feel like you're overplaying, because you're like, oh well, I hear there's all this space in the music. It actually needs something, so I'm gonna do a lot of movement, but then you're boxing in the future musicians and not leaving space for them. So you have to imagine the parts that don't exist yet when you're recording that way.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Yeah,
such a strange like foresight to try and have listening, you know, and being like, well, I can imagine what's going to be there, but is someone else going to think of that, or is that the intention of what's here? Do I ask that, or you know, and having drawing that line, so interesting.
Yeah, another thing I'll do sometimes, depending on the producer, is I'll do like, I'll give them, once I know the song and I've charted it out, I'll give them 3 takes, and one of them is very conservative, whole notes, like the most meat and potatoes bass line, and yeah. then maybe a second one which is like that and a little bit, and then a third one that's the spicy take that they can listen through, and they can say, here's my favorite lick, I'm gonna take that and drop it in with take one. Sometimes that's the workflow. My preference is to not do it that way. My preference is to make the decisions, but in the digital era where people want options, like we were talking about, like producers want to be able to go back and retroactively make their arrangement decisions, giving them the pieces so that they do have that one very rock steady, simple take, just nailing the timing, nailing a downbeat, big tone, whole notes, they have it. If you're overplaying, they can go back and take that. So I think every recording situation is different, and it really is, the tone is set by the producer and their workflow, and you kind of have to bend your creative to what works for them, and if you gel with them, then they'll ask you back. That's the whole goal, is just to get asked back, and what will get you asked back for one producer might not get you asked back for a different one. So it goes back to the thing we were saying earlier, yeah. like you have, as a bass player, you have to be a bit of a therapist to just understand what people want and what they're looking for, and then without asking them questions, give it to them. It's tricky, but it's fun.
Yeah, you're a chameleon blending in, doing everything. A therapist, a chameleon therapist.
Yeah, okay,
that's what you
bass player.
Be. Perfect. Well, chaps, I think that rounds things off very, very nicely. I hope you all have enjoyed listening to this episode. If you have got any more questions that you want to, you know, reach out to Philip to ask anything else, it's been so insightful. I can't thank you enough for coming on you know, talking nonsense and nerding out with us on this. I've certainly learned a lot, and I hope other people have as well. Philip, if people want to reach out to you or find you anywhere on the internet, mm-hmm. where can they do so?
First off, thank you so much for letting me be here. I had a great time. I learned a lot, and this was fun, so let's do it again. For finding me, my YouTube channel is probably the best way. Philip Conrad Music, Philip with one L, P-H-I-L-I-P, CONRAD Music. That's my YouTube. It's also my Instagram. That's probably a more direct way to reach out to me for communication. And yeah, thanks for having me, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Amazing. No problem at all. It's our pleasure, in fact. If you want to reach out to the show, you can do so on Instagram at In The Pocket Pod. That is In The Pocket Pod on Instagram. Please make sure you keep an eye on keep an eye out on there for future posts. Sorry, my brain's given up. I've melted away in this heat. So that you can ask your questions to this very podcast. Remember, more followers equals more guests. So let's keep that train going. You can follow me on Instagram at Johnny Dibble, and exactly the same on YouTube as well. So go and subscribe over there. Chris, where can people find you, dear?
You can find me literally everywhere under That Guy on Bass. Nice and simple. No need to learn how to spell my name or anything like that. And then, as always, please listen to my band. We're called Darla. We have just released last week our third single. Yes, our third single. It's called Landslide. It's very, very angry. It's a very angry good time, is how I'd describe it. But yeah, have a listen. If you like it, give us a follow. Let me know. If you don't like it, please don't let me know, because my fragile ego can't take it. And yeah, hope you check us out. And yeah, That Guy on Bass everywhere.
Fantastic. All the links, etc., will be in the description of this if you want to check it all out. Last bit of housekeeping before we let you go. Make sure on your listening platform of choice that you rate this podcast 5 stars so that we can reach more people. It all helps with algorithms, etc., to get it out there. So please, I always say 5 stars. It might have changed to 10 stars. Who knows? And we're saying, yeah, just give it 50%.
Can you imagine if it's changed to like 90 stars and we're asking people to give us like a 1 out of 10?
Yes, please. Good quality content. Right. Awesome. Thanks very much, chaps. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next time.
Ta-ta.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.